podcast, The Relationships We Live In. And it comes out of a conversation Jim and I have been having for a long time about how to look at things from a relationship perspective, the interconnectedness of things, more of a systems view, a view of complexity than just the individual view and perspective.
Of thinking in terms of interdependence, mutual influencing.
Reciprocity.
Right, right. Are kind of really seminal concepts. Mm-hmm. I think this is part of an ongoing conversation that many people are having throughout the world, in many fields, counseling and therapy field for sure, has started before us and is ongoing, and I hope the listeners will join in from where they're at in their relationships and take what they can from it.
I love it. I guess to start off, let's talk about how we got into a relationship.
Oh, me and you?
Yeah. So I remember being in the Masters of Counseling program at Barry and taking your class for the first time.
Right, I do remember that.
And I was just, I guess it stood out for me because it was the first time I heard something that made sense to me.
Well, you know, interesting, regardless of the topic, in terms of relationship, we met as student professor.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting dynamic in of itself, you know. I was, had the kind of anointed position of being the knowledgeable one, and you were there as a an audience. But I hope I invited you in to be a participant in talking about.
I think that's one of the things that did invite me in. Mm-hmm. I felt pulled into a dialogue where I was growing.
Was there anything that I spoke to in terms of theory or concepts that said, that's different than how I think of myself and think of relationships?
I think the idea that you introduced at the time was kind of the systems idea and the notion that if you work on yourself, you're working on the relationship, and that there's a mutual influence of in that as you work on yourself, it's going to shift the system in some way, and you're also affected by the system, but you have some autonomy in it at the same time.
I couldn't say it better, but you know, it's funny, when I first got introduced to that concept of reciprocity, mutual influence, I had a hard time making the shift. I understood it, but when it came to my relationship, I'm a married man, have a son, it was always kind of much more punctuated on them or me. I had a hard time connecting the two dots. Mm. What helped you shift to that?
Well, I think I accepted the idea before I started implementing the idea. Like, the idea made sense, that we mutually impact each other. I think I'm a people pleaser, and I like to blame myself at times and things like that. And so I think it took me a long time to realize that I was in a reciprocal relationship with people, rather than if I change myself, I'll change the other person. You know,
right.
So I was still trying to do the individual thing,
right?
Though I knew the concept.
Right. I hear you. Not unsimilar to me. You know, as we're talking about relationship and the concepts of relationships and systems, I wonder to what extent, although that is speaks to our intelligence, our brains, there's something going on in all relationships that are more emotional, more energetic, more, you know, what's this guy thinking of me? How do people see me? That kind of thing.
Kind of a concern about the other?
A concern about the other, a concern about how the other is thinking of me, and somehow there's magic when that kind of doesn't evaporate, becomes less, goes more to the background. And I wonder if it is the theory that helps people stay more focused on keeps the conversation going and not affected by what the other thinks.
Somebody's able to stay more kind of in their own head rather than getting caught up in
right.
Somebody else's
head. Or begin to challenge that idea. Mm. You know, how do relationships provide for the ability to kind of deal with disapproval?
Mm.
You know,
the relationship can, if we're unaware in the relationship, we're not aware of the reciprocity, you know, we're just acting in them day in, day out. Right. That's how we develop these things of fear of disapproval.
Right.
But it's, we solve them in the relationship.
Right.
By recognizing the reciprocity.
We become friends first and know each other second. You know, the question I ask is, how can one be themselves and be one with what they believe and think when they can't tolerate the discomfort of the relationship, mm-hmm. of disapproval in the relationship, of lack of acceptance?
Kind of like if I, holding on to my way, not my way or the highway, holding on to the way I think about things,
mm-hmm.
and not changing it just because of the pressure of the relationship
in some way. Right. I used to say, people say, you know, what's your orientation, what do you do? I say it was the last book I read. So talk about being influenced, you know, I don't even need another, you know, I could be, well, ideas are very influential, you know.
Well, ideas, I think I've been thinking a lot about the fact that relationships are influential too. The ideas inhabit us to some degree.
Right. They get life or grow in the relationship.
Mm.
In other words, two people can tell you the same thing, and you can respond very differently to the same message.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that this morning. I was reading Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about, in the book, he was talking about the return from having found the treasure of the hero finds mm-hmm. the treasure, but now he's got to return back to the world.
Right.
You know, I feel like in relationships, it's like I recognize something about myself or the nature of the relationship, my part in it, but now I have to enact that in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like bringing yourself back with new eyes.
Yes, so exactly. Right. Exactly.
Which then changes the ongoing relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, earlier on we were talking about authenticity, what that means, you know. And I wonder if that's what is the promise of a relationship, to be able to aspire to being your true self, your best self, in connection to others.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of people say to me, it's easy being myself when I'm alone. I said, me too.
Yeah.
You know? But I don't know if that's the best way to serve yourself. Yeah.
No. I have the thought at times that it has to play out in the relationships or it's not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
No.
I guess the chicken egg question. One doesn't become authentic and then has more genuine relationships. One is authentic in a relationship, and it kind of gives a deeper sense of oneself.
Mm-hmm. Or, okay. I would think of it an unfolding. Like it's always unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm always becoming more of myself in relationship to others.
I like that. More of myself in relationship to others. Can't know myself outside of a relationship.
Right. Absolutely.
Right. Knowing that, I'm wondering how it's changed how you are in relationship, how you think about the intimate relationships of your life.
how thinking this way has helped and changed.
How you show up.
Well, I think, I hope it's made me more aware of myself. I think I've had the tendency to focus on pleasing others in life.
That's something you see a lot in your relationship network.
Yeah.
How you show up.
Yeah. And be focusing on how I can calm others down, make others happy. So I think thinking in terms of reciprocity has helped me recognize that pattern and that there's maybe there's some usefulness to that position at times, but there's a lot of things that aren't useful about it.
So break that down for me, that reciprocity is in pleasing others, it comes back to you in a favorable way.
Sometimes.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes. Well, there's good parts of being able to be tuned into others.
Right.
You can, you tend to be able to be aware of others' emotions, be able to put others at ease, things like that.
Right.
Be inviting, create a warm atmosphere.
Right.
The cost of it is you lose energy to being overly focused on others and not putting energy toward your own life goals.
Right.
So I think that's one place where it helped me. I started to realize, oh, I'm spinning my wheels in life because I'm not putting enough energy toward my own life goals.
In some ways, it's you're less than present.
You're less of yourself.
Right, less of yourself.
Less than you could be if you were putting that energy toward your life.
Right. I hear you. How much of that pattern, because you sound very aware, worked on it.
That's, it's a trick.
In other words, it's operative. It's part of who you are.
Yeah.
It's not something to rid yourself of, but to manage differently.
Exactly.
Right.
I was thinking and listening, just this idea that problems are opportunities.
Mm.
You know, and I think that the patterns in our life that can become problematic can also help us find solutions and help us grow.
Mm-hmm.
Like in fact,
I wonder, without them, do we grow?
I don't think we do grow.
You so much to say, we never argue.
Yeah.
I wonder what that's about. You know.
What about you? I was talking about me.
Yeah.
What's been a pattern in your life that you kind of maybe recognized?
Well, similarly, I'm a pleaser, but I'm much more a conflict avoider. I'm much more a conflict avoider. I detest disapproval. I don't know why. You know, I don't know what that says about me and myself, that I need the approval of others. I think it speaks to the quality of myself, of just how solid I am in self. And what I find very interesting, the more opportunities to be a self, show a self, respond as a self, lets me know where I'm not a self.
So it's
kind of this notion of self is a very kind of ambiguous, it's a hard to grasp kind of thing. It you know, when we think of self, we think of our corporal self, and yet that really just is the housing in which we have. In fact, when you think of relationship, I'm tied to you. There's a bond.
Yes.
It's an emotional field. It's a invisible umbilical cord in some ways.
Yeah.
And those cords are life determining.
Mm-hmm.
Without them, we don't thrive. Mm-hmm. And yet risking them being cut is an existential crisis, I think.
The threat of being disconnected.
Disconnected. It's as fundamental, maybe more fundamental, than a nutrition in food. You know, in fact, some of the early Bowlby studies were that orphan children rather be held, although this was with the monkeys, they rather hold a cloth monkey than be fed. I think it's at that
the contact,
level.
What?
The contact. The contact was essential to their well-being. And so I think my disapproval at the level of my living with it, appreciating it, seeing the persistence of it, lets me know just how fragile how important connections are, and the threat or loss of them is a vulnerability that you know, I tap into from now. So connections is you know, connections are embedded. Relationship is one way of connection. It's almost fundamental, but we need to be connected to the earth, you know, to communities. You know, I don't know if it's a ever-expanding circle, but they strike me as all essential to who we are, the self.
I like this idea of the threat of connection, the threat of losing connection.
Right.
It's really such a fundamental driver of the patterns we develop in life.
Yeah, and how it shapes the self we can be.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like... to the extent that we are threatened, we limit being ourselves, showing up.
Showing up. One way.
It's an amazing phenomenon, isn't it?
It really.
Anyway, two adult, I think, pretty mature men. We're pretty functional in our lives, and we're talking about stuff that is so elemental, and yet life shaping, relationship shaping.
We sure spend a lot of energy trying to stay connected.
Yeah. Some of us put our energy in kind of avoiding that for the threat of...
For the...
It goes two sides of a coin.
So you're saying people avoid it in order to what? Avoid connection?
It's like, I don't need that. It's a kind of a delusion of self as a way. It's a fundamental protection. I don't need it. Because it's, you know, if I want it, I'll never get enough of it. Once given, I can't live without it. You know, and yet, isolated people, the most marginal of people, have some connection to the to. They have to have a connection. You know, they're longing for connection, and yet they act like they don't sometimes.
Thinking of the difference between isolation and loneliness. I can be alone and not be lonely,
right.
Or I can be lonely in the crowd.
Right.
Maybe that.
You know, I think if we pull back and look more societally, loneliness is endemic to us. You know, people are feeling disconnected from each other, from community.
In spite of the fact that we're more connected technologically.
Yeah, right.
So,
I got 1,000 Facebook friends.
Yeah, but I'm depressed and lonely.
And what are your thoughts about that? How that has contributed to the phenomena of the challenge of staying connected, being connected anyway, where we have this technological ability to kind of pseudo connect.
I'm thinking about what you said earlier, this kind of invisible connection we had between us, or people have between each other, that really can be a challenge, but it can also be such a comfort and producer, a gift of energy for life. It can make you feel good. And I think the connecting technologically can provide some of that, but it can also be a way. I think pseudo is a good word for it that you use. It's a pseudo connection.
It's kind of a palliative, a quick fix.
Yeah,
it doesn't really promote. It offers the possibility, but it in some ways people have been seduced in thinking that's enough.
Yes.
It's a sorry state of affairs for the state of relationships in that regard.
Yeah.
You know?
It's maybe it's a way to manage the anxiety of not having positive, deep connections in real life.
Right, right. Yeah, I see more and more of that. It also speaks to, I think, people's longing for a spiritual connection. Mm. You know, that people are going that route. I don't know if it's independent or because of, but a lot of people are on a spiritual journey now to connect to something bigger than themselves. Yeah. Well, you know, when we talk about just one-on-one relationships, we're talking about something that's bigger than I or you.
Yeah.
So it's a we that is certainly more than each other.
I think when you work on connecting with another person in a meaningful way, I think you are participating in something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Something about, I don't know, the nature of reality or something.
Well, certainly the nature of our reality.
Our reality.
I think people who are in good relationship give off, if you will, good vibes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's tangible. You feel it. Oh. You know, presence of people are, you know, at home with themselves. They're at home in relationship.
Mm-hmm. Something that can be themselves.
Yeah. When I think of the notion of home, the concept, I think of relationships in my home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't come home to my my house.
Come home to the relationship.
Right, right. You know, I like the house and my comfortable chair. But, you know, if it was an empty house, I could go to, you know, a Hyatt.
No, it's really true because, you know, my wife's away right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the house is just a house. It's nice, but it's
definitely
not the same as having the relationship in it.
Yeah. I'll never forget when my mom died and my father said, I come home and I miss the patter of my wife's footsteps.
Oh.
It struck me so at the level of, you know, it wasn't of a hello. It was just the sound of her presence.
Mm-hmm.
It really was quite remarkable.
That's a beautiful way to put it. I told my wife something similar.
I
just miss your presence.
It can be so soothing. And yet, you know, as I know in my marriage, it doesn't take much to have that turn on and done.
So that the connection has two sides to it.
Yeah.
The intensity can have two sides to it. You can have positive and challenging.
Someone, I forgot who it was, named that hate love. It comes out of love. It comes out of the breaking of the love being your partner or your the other you're in relationship with, disappointing you, not being the other you want.
Yeah.
You know, which is an ongoing struggle. And if you're in a relationship long enough, you're disappointed. How you manage it is really important.
Mm.
That word has come up a few times.
Which one?
Managing self in a relationship.
Mm.
I wonder if you could say a little more about that, because I think that's the best we can do in a relationship, to keep it growing,
mm-hmm.
To stop it from biting us back. From us either walking away or the other kind of distancing or escalating into some conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say a little more about your thinking on the management of self in a relationship?
Yeah. Well, we're both counselors.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you, well, I don't know, maybe your experience is different, but when people come in with an issue, their focus is usually on someone else, what someone else did or didn't do, or how the circumstances kind of pinning them down.
And not react a certain way.
Yeah. Which some of that might be valid, but part of the work when you sit with somebody after bringing the anxiety down, it's just like shifting the lens back to themselves. Because people so want, just instinctively, I think, to try to manage the other to calm themselves down. You know, so
if instinctively, the say it again.
I think instinctively, people tend to view the threat as in the other person.
Right.
And so, I think we're programmed to be threat perceivers of threat, to be really good at detecting threat.
Right.
And so,
even when it's not there.
And as humans, not only can we detect real threats, but we can imagine threats where there aren't any.
Right.
And so, you know, you're sitting with a guy and he's talking about his wife, and you're listening to the story, and it might be that as it unfolds, well, what got you going in that moment? He says, oh, it was her tone of voice. Oh, it wasn't even what she said. It was you perceived that her tone of voice, a threat, and that triggered something in you, and you something in you shifted.
Right.
And so then you can start to think about, help this person think about their part in the interplay of the relationship.
To begin to manage self.
In other words, oh, okay, I'm having a reaction.
Right.
To my perception of the other.
Real or imagined. Would you say that's the default mode by which humans kind of function?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it serves a purpose, survival.
It's an early on survival strategy.
Yeah, we have to be able to perceive threats to adapt.
Right. Do you know the difference between real and imagined threats when you're experiencing the threat?
It's really hard in the moment.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it starts with reflecting.
Well, you're ahead of me. That's good. I just kind of try to put out the fire. But my point is, I don't think once it gets triggered, it's experienced like the real thing.
I think, I think even the physiological, the thoughts that come up.
I don't know about you, but about 90% of the people that come to me with threats are imagined.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or blown out of proportion.
Yeah, right.
Which is imagined.
Right. So managing self is key to a richer relationship. What if the other doesn't manage themselves?
Oh, I hear that all the time. I also hear, why am I the one that has to do all the work? Well, what else are you going
to do? Who's here? Who's here? What are you trying to do to get her to come in?
How good are you at convincing the other person?
The theory holds, I think, that if you change, it may change the relationship. How could it not?
Yeah.
If you're part of the system.
But the trick is you can't work on changing yourself with an eye on the other person at the same time.
Mm.
Even though that might be maybe a physical law, let's say, if it was, right?
Yeah.
If I change myself, the other might change.
Right.
If I try to change myself with the goal of changing the other, it never works.
Right.
You know?
I hear. It's kind of like faith.
Yeah.
You gotta just take it on faith. There's no guarantees, you know. And maybe it's feedback that you need to kind of do it a little differently.
Yeah.
You know? I hear you. I was just going to say something. Oh, there was a great play back in the day in the Gables. Is the Gable Theater still there?
Yes. Yeah, Miracle Mile Theater.
Maybe you heard it or saw it. The title of the play was I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. I think that captures for me the couples that come, you know?
Yeah.
I love you, you're perfect, not change. It certainly applied in my marriage, it has, you know? Loving the person, but wanting to make them into my version of what a partner is. You know what I found? The more I did that, the less I was able to see who I was and what I needed to improve on.
The more you focused
on
changing
the other,
yeah.
I lost sight of what I brought to the relationship, what I wanted to change, needed to change, improve on, that was at odds with my values, and yet, you know, it was a great fail-safe, kept me from having to look at my dirt.
Mm-hmm. It's a way to manage self without managing self.
It's a go-to managing self practice that is kata.
Yeah. If I can focus on the other and how they should be different, then it'll calm me down a little bit.
Right. And the physiology of that is we are programmed to focus on the other.
Yeah.
You know, we're not a threat to ourselves. The external world is a threat. Mm-hmm. So we're going against our physiology.
In trying to shift the lens back to oneself.
Right. It's kind of counter evolution.
Yeah.
Right.
How does focusing on the facts help? Somebody told me that once. I found it so useful.
Well, I think it is important that we are so subjective in our perceptions of others. I don't think we have a lot of objectivity or even make the distinction. Facts provide us a bit of neutrality and the opportunity to sort out our wishes, our hopes, our expectations from what is.
Mm.
So facts are really important.
Okay.
Although we're in a post-fact world, so it's kind of complicated. We've got a dominant story that they don't matter, you know.
My facts, not your facts.
Right. But that's another battle of opinions, right?
Yeah.
Well, but facts are very specific. They're not facts of your date of birth. They're facts of observable things in the relationship.
Right. Facts of functioning, right. What people do.
When she yells at me, it's a fact that I withdraw.
Yeah.
That is observable. Mm-hmm. It's also predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's modifiable.
Yep. In other words, if I can pay attention to that and notice that when the other yells, I withdraw,
right.
Or when the other's intensity goes up in some way, I distance.
Yeah, for sure.
Then I can pay attention to that process in myself, and the next time the intensity comes up, try to manage it, try to maybe stay present,
right.
Or
and see what difference that makes.
And see what,
What you're really talking about is talking about the process in relationship between people that they bring from prior generations, but also create or recreate in their current relationship.
So what, use the one we were just doing. What do you mean by prior generations? How does, when somebody's intensity goes up, this person withdraws.
Right.
How does that relate to the prior generations?
Okay, in my family, we were... problems were always pushed under the table. There was a certain threat or communication that in this family, we don't disagree.
Mm.
We don't disagree. I heard that, but I absorbed that. You know, it wasn't told to me. It was understood by me, by living in my household. And I don't know if I passed that on to my son, but clearly, it was inherited, and as it evolved, it became, I married a non-confrontational woman.
Thank God.
Yes. I'd have to stay in my room at all times. I wouldn't have been able to come over here today. For sure.
So patterns, even if it's the same pattern doesn't get repeated, What transpires in the generation above influences what comes down.
The anxiety gets passed on, the sense of discomfort, right? And then people in living practice just kind of develop a pattern. It helps the first time, it sticks, and then you own it, you know, without even knowing. I think that's the way into self-management.
Mm.
So, beginning to observe and appreciate the patterns by which you live.
I agree 100%. Yeah. Observation, awareness.
I think observation is 50% of the ballgame.
What's that saying? You can't change what you can't see.
Right.
I think you might have told me.
Yeah, that. I don't know, but I'll take credit for it. You know what I think is the hardest thing? given how relationships work, is the ability to look at oneself. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to look at others, blame, criticize, but to look at oneself is just a real challenge. It takes a lot of maturity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I love that word, maturity. It speaks to so much, you know, because there's maturity, immaturity.
Yeah,
it's a two-sided coin. And most of us have a little or some of both. Hopefully more maturity than immaturity. But, you know, it's like if you put a red drop of dye in a water beaker, it makes the whole thing red. Doesn't require a lot of immaturity to mess things up, you know? It really kind of steals the show.
It definitely,
do you use that term?
Maturity, immaturity? Yeah. Was that how much of that was your immaturity? How much of that was your maturity? Yeah. What would it look like to move from your immaturity to your more mature response?
I think it's a word everyone identifies with.
Yeah. You know?
Sure. Most of the people I work with initially have a hard time accepting there's relationships trigger threats.
Mm.
It's kind of, they're anxious, they're stressed, they react, but they don't appreciate how fundamental that is.
Relationships trigger stress.
Right. Relationship, they're in the relationship, it triggers their immaturity.
Okay.
But they don't initially appreciate how fundamental those threats are.
Mm.
I don't know what that is, or my understanding of it, but it's maybe it just keeps the focus on the other, but you know.
What were the four general sensitivities humans have?
Attention, acknowledgement, expectations, and distress.
In other words, those are things we're sensitive to in a relationship,
right.
To others.
Right.
Attention, approval. Right.
Either we're getting
expectations,
not enough attention, acknowledgement, too much expectations we have of them or them of us, and just general distress.
Yeah. And so when we sense those things, that activates our immature response.
Right.
Why aren't you paying attention to me?
The red flag goes up. But that speaks to then, I think, maybe you just answered my question. I think it speaks to the content process distinction.
Mm.
People are so caught up in the content. She doesn't come over and watch TV with me.
You know,
that kind of thing. It's an easy behavior. How come? They don't understand it as a sensitivity. It's, you know, all she has to do is sit next to me. You know.
Why is she avoiding me?
Yeah.
Instead of the process would be, I get reactive when I feel she's
avoiding
me in some way. When I perceive that.
Right.
You know, I was just thinking as you were talking about what was useful in my education and in our early relationship was you being telling your own stories.
Mm. Yeah.
And using examples from your life about your effort to be more mature. And you were open about your immaturity and kind of your journey in the process of working on yourself. And I found that so useful.
You know, it's funny, in quotes, we're supposed to be mutual people as counselors, as therapists. There's something to be said about that, but I also I find it has helped so many of my clients when I manage myself well and share a story about my immaturity that connects the dot for them.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay, I see that. I can see that myself. Well, yeah, that's what I do instead of that. Do you share?
I do.
Okay.
Share stories of my own life, or stories even that I've heard from colleagues.
Yeah, yeah. Is your experience most of your colleagues comfortable sharing that, or they think it's a transgression?
It depends. I think there's different realms of the counseling therapy world, mm-hmm. you know. And I think the realm we're both in, yeah. people are more comfortable sharing yeah. personal stories. In other realms, people are less
right.
comfortable.
Right, right. I just was at a book signing, a good friend of mine, who's really been challenged living with bipolar. Mm-hmm. Really made a hell of a heck of a life, but she's, you know, got her counseling degrees, really developed a practice, and wrote a book, Being a Bipolar Therapist. And she really tells a very personal story. And I have a two-way reading of her. I knew her when she first started and seen her evolution, and the book just tells a beautiful story of it. She's got so many rave responses from telling that story mm. to her clientele and to people who read it and struggle with it or have a loved one who struggles with it. That's a connecting thing. Mm-hmm. Now the question is, how do you manage that in a way where you don't just dump it on the person and say, thanks for sharing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But, or just take on somebody's yeah. Story.
Yeah. But, you know, as we're talking today, you know, in terms of some of our traditional, typical ways of engagement, I just opened a whole new notion for me is, how do people connect? I don't think I've ever asked the question that way.
How do you connect?
Yeah, I mean, what's your ways of connecting? And it just strikes me as, I ask it in different ways, but I like that question.
Yeah. How do you connect?
How do you connect with them? With others, with yourself.
That's an interesting one, especially with yourself. How do you connect?
Yeah, where, you know, what kind of strengthens the connections? And, seems like a neutral question in some ways, but yeah. speaks powerfully.
Yeah, how do you connect? With yourself, with others? Because yeah. We live in the connections.
Right. Well, you know, the interesting thing about living in the community, we live in the relationships, and yet they're not always working in our best interest or the interest of the others. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're living in them in ways that continually will help us grow, but challenge us to be our mature selves. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Maybe that was the grand design.
Yeah.
You know?
That relationships teach us to grow.
Right.
Somewhere.
That not only teach us to grow, but require us to grow.
Require us to grow. I like that better.
Require us
to grow. I think that's true.
It's a requirement. And we were once at a conference where the guy was talking about friction. Without friction, there's no movement, there's no growth.
Yeah.
It's a spark.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that's the relationship friction.
Yeah.
It's a life, it's potentially life generating. It burned the house down, but it's life
generating at the same time.
Yeah. Do you think people have an idealized version of relationships? That, you know, we see a bit skewed from a certain theoretical lens. Do you think most people, the ordinary Joe, how do you think they think of relationship? An idealized way, Hollywood version, too much trouble? How do you think?
My guess would be some idealized version like would be maybe the more
you mean,
general
lightning struck.
Yeah,
lightning struck.
Yeah. Instead of what you're saying, it's like relationships grow us up.
Right.
You know? And how do we work? How do we stay connected? Be ourselves in the connection. Work on the connection.
What relationships must be redefine for that your primary relationship, your intimate relationship, to grow.
What's the question?
What other relationships, other than your primary relationship? You know, I mean, if we take the normative course, people leave their family, they grow up, and they meet someone and they start a life.
Yeah.
What relationships have to change for that relationship to jettison, to take hold?
I think the the relationships you're emerging from.
Yeah.
You know, your family, mostly your family of origin.
Right.
You know, how are you maturing? Kind of as
how mature are you in leaving?
Yeah, in leaving.
Yeah.
Are you running away from your family, or did you grow away?
Right. That is one of the great questions I have. Everyone, you know, who I ask that of, it gets them to think about the context, the influences, the invisible cords that have held them.
To bring it back to connection, how does my connection with my family impact my romantic?
And does anyone ever resolve those connections?
Or to what degree?
To what degree?
To what degree do we resolve them? Or how can I work on, now, given that, you know, somebody's 30 years old, how do they work on those early connections in the present so that they can have better relationships outside of the family?
Right.
Or in starting a new family?
Don't you think if you're working on a relationship with your partner, it's a doorway, or it's inferred, inherently, that you're working on your primary relationships?
Yeah, you're working, yes, I think so. I think, and when you work on those relationships, because you're working on the part of yourself that's, you're working on the immaturity.
Right. Doesn't matter who it's with.
Yeah, you can work at it from either angle.
Right.
Both are going to help each other.
You know, we were talking earlier about fathers. Most of my work with my family has always been around my mother early on. You know,
interesting.
It's kind of a psychoanalytic thing, you know, me and my mother. And over the last several years, I've been thinking much more about my relationship with my father.
What shifted?
What shifted? My taking on my relationship with my son.
Made you think more about...
Yeah, I think there's an inverse relationship to how I'm with my son as to how I was with my dad. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to make sense of... I had a very strong connection to my father. He to me, and me to him more than him to me. You don't need another to feel that connected. You don't need the other to be as connected to you.
In other words, you can feel the intensity of it regardless of what they're
doing. Yes, right. And reciprocity may be the lack of on the other part. The more intensity on your part,
the less
has to do with the less was on the plate. You know? But I think the shift was definitely my thinking about my challenges with my son, him with me, and me with him.
You know, when you were just talking about your mom, it made me, I remember the story that you told. You were talking about how you function in the present. I think you were working on like under-functioning. Doing less at the time.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, I still have to wear Velcro shoes because my mom tied my shoes until I was 20.
Right.
I was over-exaggerating.
Felt like 20. Yeah, I was stuck there in that 20-year period. But it's an endless kind of it's such a gold mine of possibilities, of resources, of treasures, of delights, of pitfalls, of and it's certainly never static.
Never static.
It's always moving.
Relationships, families.
Comings and goings, the endings of relationships, the beginnings.
I was remembering a conversation you had once. We were talking about transitions and like liminal spaces in life.
Right.
What was your experience with kind of moving through those transitional periods and how that impacted your relationships? Or how it impacts relationships?
Well, let me say, liminal space, I think, is such a rich, fertile ground for growth if one kind of frames it that way. I'm betwixt in between, you know. I love the analogy of an explorer going from the old world to discover the new world. Gets far enough for sure that he can't see the old world, but not close enough and near enough to see the new world. Mm-hmm. And yet he knows it's there, or he has hopes that there's a new world, and he's in that betwixt in between. He can't go back, he can't go forward. Yeah. That for me is the transition.
I love this metaphor. What guides somebody in that place?
Mm.
Great
question.
Or what compels them, maybe?
Yeah. I think at that point, looking back in mine, I didn't have much of a map for a lot of it. But what guides me now is my values. Mm-hmm. You know, how I want to be, what I believe in, how I want to conduct myself.
Yeah.
So that's a big thing. I don't know if that's useful in a pragmatic way for people, but for me it was, you know, when I was walking down a road and not knowing what lies ahead, that steadied me a bit. And that was, you know, my values have changed. Not have much changed. I've come to know and define my values as time has gone on.
I was thinking something similar, that's the pragmatics of
it. Yeah, you're right.
Right?
The defining.
The defining of it. Right. You might not know the value or the principle until you're in the uncharted
right.
waters.
Well, I think it's an opportunity to kind of, if you don't have your values clear, to begin to define them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to be traveling in uncharted waters for a long time.
Yeah.
Right, for sure. You'll be, tide flows.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's that. But I love that term, liminality. I don't know if it's used much. It came from my work with Michael White, talked about liminality. And there was a woman, she was a sociologist, she did this work with elderly Jewish people who were people, they were unseen, you know, they were old, wasted, and they began to define themselves as community. I forget, it was Barbara Meyerhoff, sociologist, really important, I have to review that, but they kind of became witness to and a relationship that revived all of them, you know. But it was a transition to either being, you know, set adrift or say, hey, who are we? You
know? Interesting.
Yeah.
And Michael White is the narrative.
Yes, right.
Narrative theorist,
yeah.
Therapist.
He very much talks about values and principles too. I think there's a lot more common with narrative and bone than people want to think,
yeah,
for sure.
Just for those watching, Bowen theory is a theory that you were teaching me when natural family system.
Right. And you took to it.
Yeah.
Right.
This idea that we exist in systems that evolve and adapt over time.
And to answer your question further, I think Bowen theory has some theoretical underpinnings that can be a guide to turbulent times.
Yeah.
But, you know, help you monitor your maturity, how you are yourself, how you want to show up. Is that in line with what you believe? You know? Very much so. It's an interesting reckoning when you realize how you behave is at odds with what you value.
Yeah.
Takes too much alcohol to forget that one.
Well, what was the saying? There's two ways to solve problems.
Yeah.
You can use substances, or you can be more of a self.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, relationships can be a very potent substance in terms of dependence and for growing self.
Yeah,
you know, really is. That's the real interesting part of relationships. It has both possibilities.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm always struck by is that I think the more mature one gets, the more of a self one becomes, there's a playfulness that can be a characteristic of that.
Yeah.
It's like it allows you to be more playful.
Yeah, right.
When you know what you value, when you know who you are, you can you can play.
Right, right, absolutely. Right, for sure. That I think that's one of the real benefits of working on yourself.
You know,
you're comfortable being a jerk.
I need to work on that. I think what you mean is that you're comfortable if somebody views your position as a jerk.
Right. It's like dancing,
especially when you know it's not.
It's like singing in the shower or dancing naked.
Yeah.
You know?
You do that?
No. I do a lot of jerky things. So it's an endless topic, relationships. I mean, we've been just going back and forth. It stimulates some of my thinking about relationships in non-therapeutic ways, just thinking about it, the richness of it, the mystery of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a science to relationships, but you don't want to mess with some of the mystery.
I don't think you can take it out.
No.
I think it's always going to be there.
Yeah. Who else do you think, or that you have come across, speaks to valid understandings of relationships that can help people enrich theirs?
That's a good question. I think natural family systems theory, sure. Bone theory, has been a big one for me. I think I was talking with somebody the other day about Viktor Frankl. You know, Man's Search for Meaning, logotherapy. Right. This idea that we always have a choice about how to respond, and even in circumstances outside of our control.
Right.
And I think that can be really useful in every relationship.
Yeah.
Is how am I perceiving this? What am I bringing to the table? An existentialist view.
His great phrase was, before every action, reactions, there's a space.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where we overlook. You know, we just automatically respond, react. And in that space, if you can manage that space in ways that are keeping with how you want to be, who you want to be, endless possibility. Listen, he survived the Holocaust.
Yep.
Came out thriving.
Yep.
Quite remarkable.
Another one I just thought of is Carl Rogers. Just this idea of that the power of listening and attending in a relationship to somebody else.
Mm.
Without letting your own, injecting your own perspective automatically.
Yeah,
you know, really listening to who somebody is, what they're thinking, being curious, I think.
It brings up the notion that some people misread some of what we're talking about is, you're only thinking about yourself, aren't you being selfish?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, but listening is an incredible skill, you know.
I think
I may have shared it in class at one point, but this psychiatrist from Norway, Anderson, Tom Anderson, could listen in ways he had elephant ears. He could hear the unsaid.
I like that.
It was beautiful. But, you know, so there's so much to listen for.
Yeah. I think there's a paradox in relationships, right? In order to have better relationship, I have to manage myself rather than focusing on the other.
It gives you a greater empathy and a sense of the other.
That's the paradox, right? The more I'm able to manage my own self, the more I can be observant of myself, the more I can be attentive in the relationship, because less of my automatic stuff is getting in the way.
Right.
Less of my immaturity.
Absolutely.
And I think over time, if we do it over time, that becomes the observation, the managing becomes more automatic.
Yeah.
And then or even more.
It's a counterpoint to authenticity.
Yeah,
it becomes a practice, a habit.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, it takes seven times usage of a word to be part of your vocabulary. We're talking about imprinted behaviors going back our lives, mm-hmm. past generations. You know, it's not as easy as just getting new vocabulary.
No, it's not. It takes a lot of iteration and acting it out in relationship.
So what's your hope for this podcast?
My hope is that people will listen, and it'll introduce, help them think a little bit, maybe more broadly, think differently about their life. Mm. Get a little bit of a different perspective. Maybe I can get less reactive. Maybe I can, that my relationships are important. And, I think we're living in a world where people cut off really easily from unpleasant things, mm-hmm. And there's a lot of focus on others. There's a lot of polarization.
Yeah.
And like if this can open some kind of door to connecting people, to bring it back to connection.
Right.
I think that would be my hope. Better connections in the world.
Great. Help you be a better connector.
Yeah. This is one attempt to do that.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Thank you, Jim.